Miss Ostrovsky. Chimerical.
May I have a definition?
It means unreal, magical, visionary, wildly fanciful, highly unrealistic.
Chimerical. C-H-I-M-E-R-I-C-A-L. Highly unrealistic, wildly fanciful.
That is correct. Welcome back to Walking Away from Arcadia, a Changeling the Dreaming podcast. I'm Victor Kinzer, and my co-host is Simon Eichhornchen. And today, we're going to be talking about a couple topics that honestly confound a lot of people who play in the world of darkness: chimerical reality and the dreaming, which are closely related but are actually wildly different things. So, starting on the surface, in that thing that intersects where we all live, chimerical reality. And I'm going to let Simon take this one away, because of the two of us, he has certainly experimented with this more in his games.
So in Changeling, you've got about three different levels of reality you're dealing with at any given time. You've got the material world, the autumn world, the iron world, whatever they're going to call it in whichever particular thing you're dealing with. That's all physical. That's bodies, that's trees, that's desks, that's stuff you can reach out and touch. Then you've got the dreaming, which is Changeling's version of the Umbra, more or less. It's a little different from the Umbra, but close enough. You have to actually physically enter it somehow in order to be there. You can't just be in both places at once. And then you have chimerical reality. And chimerical reality is squishy. It's sort of the place where physical reality and the dreaming coexist. Any character in Changeling can perceive chimerical reality at any given time, although different characters have different amounts of facility with that, depending on their Kenning score, which is Changeling's awareness, right? Awareness is the magic one?
Yeah, awareness. Alertness is just, oh, I noticed that person watching me from a corner, but awareness is, I can tell what sphere magic you're doing. And yeah, Kenning is basically awareness, but only for chimerical magic.
Sure. So, with different facilities with Kenning, you have a different perception of reality. Although everybody in the game, depending on where you want to put your power level more or less, can see into chimerical reality if they really need to. So a good example of chimerical reality is to overlay the emotional impact of a physical thing onto it through chimera. So you might have a building that the majority of the tenants in it are all psychologists who specialize in childhood delusions. And in chimerical reality, depending on whether those psychologists were autumn people or not, you might have that building take on a very menacing sort of appearance. The shadows get deeper, the cracks in the walls get bigger. You might see not exactly spooky things, but things that make you think gray thoughts. But if they're not autumn people and they're just treating these children who have typical childhood delusions, then the emotional impact of the children probably takes four, and the place takes on a wildness where the little plants in the corners take over the entire room, where you might have actual spooky monsters running in and out of vision, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, and the thing that I find really compelling about chimerical reality is it seems to sort of have the same purpose as the division between the physical world and the Shadowlands, or the division between the physical world and the astral plane, or the Umbra, but the difference is you can interact with it without going anywhere, and it's almost like being in the Umbra, but being completely exposed. Because if you're a werewolf and you step sideways, or you're a dream speaker and you slip into the Umberwood spheres, no one else can see you, and you can do all of your spiritual craziness and then come back and sort of wipe your hands and it's no big thing and fine, whatever. But you can't do that with chimerical reality. It's in that respect much more dangerous. If there's a chimera wreaking absolute havoc in the mall, which admittedly will probably be short-lived because the mall is pretty banal, but it could do some damage before it's done, and you want to go and fight it off, you then have to expose yourself to the world while you're doing it. And that creates some kind of higher stakes dynamics than a lot of the spiritual shenanigans you get into in the other games.
Right, and in the case where you're trying to fight a chimera in public, you end up with a really interesting dynamic going on, because in Changeling, they don't have a vulgar coincidental divide. They have a, would a reasonable person look at you and not think you're insane divide, because you can, as rare as glamour actually is, you can affect chimerical reality with chimerical spells as much as you want. It's free. It's when you start trying to impact material reality that you have to start paying glamour points to do your spells. So, like in Mage, it behooves you to try to clear the room a little bit if you're going to be doing something strange in public, or at the very least to enchant all the witnesses, which would be pretty expensive. But you can also be really clever with how you're doing it, because now we have flash mobs, now we have historical reenactors, LARP groups that run all over the place. So you really just need to be careful about how you're presenting, which involves a level of preparation that a lot of people don't actually get into.
Yeah, well, and that's one thing that I really like about the new cantrip rules is in Changeling 20th, which is will probably have dropped by the time this podcast goes live. It hasn't at the time of our recording, but they did release the cantrip rules, or an early draft of them, when they did the Kickstarter, and they've changed bunks so that there are different grades of bunks, and there's what's called an epic bunk, and or legendary, I think it's legendary bunk. And it's basically the sort of thing like with Sleeping Beauty, the taking the time to do the spindle on the spinning wheel, and, you know, yes, you can get rid of every single spinning wheel. It doesn't matter. One will make itself. There will be one hidden. The fate has made certain that that will happen. That whole setup and, you know, manipulation to get Aurora into the right place at the right time would be a legendary bunk. And it kind of reframes things, especially if you're doing, you know, Changeling is more urban, so there are things like flash mobs, you know, it's a modern game, makes sense. But it's an interesting reframing because it puts the players in a position where they have a systematic goal that invokes some of those things. And that's new in this most recent edition, and I think that it's a good design to kind of draw players into that mode of thinking.
I'm really looking forward to getting the chance to read those rules and figuring out what I'm going to do with them, because they sound really interesting. Also, chimerical reality pulls on an idea that I think Americans generally are less familiar with than a lot of other people, the exception, of course, being Native Americans, but where the spiritual and the material aren't divorced, where you don't go to church once a week and that's your spiritual activity. You don't go to a meditation class once a week and that's your spiritual activity. A lot of traditions, they weave their story making and, you know, capital letters story making into their everyday lives. And it's that's what chimerical reality comes across as to me. It's not that you have this great outside force of the Dreaming or the Umbra or whatever invading. It's that you have a perceptual shift more than anything else.
You know, something that I was just thinking of as you were sort of describing that, to get a little bit more removed and get into the history of the World of Darkness and some of the weird cosmology about the way the universe is structured, which is usually the purview of mage and maybe a little werewolf, but I think it has a place here, is in the World of Darkness, in the Mythic Age, so arguably Exalted, but you don't have to use that prequel hook, so even in the sort of Mythic Age that gets talked about just in the World of Darkness books, spirit and physical reality were one. It was one space. There was no gauntlet or Shadowlands. Well, there was Shadowlands, but there was no shroud. Nothing separated them. And then things sort of separated, and all of the other spiritual realms were completely separated from the physical world. And the game that really deals with the how and the why of that is Mage. And Mage talks a lot about all of those divisions being driven on human belief. What do humans believe? All humans are kind of doing very low-level magic all the time. In Changeling, it would be called weaving. Humans are very good at weaving, and the Fae are really the only other creatures that weave. That's why they have the more dynamic magic systems, as opposed to werewolves and vampires that really have much more limited specific things they can do. But humans and Fae weave new things. And in Dark Ages Fae, they talked about it was actually a bit of a shock. Humans were better at it than the Fae were, even though, according to the Fae, they're the ones who taught them. So humans are doing this thing with their belief all the time. And so the Umbra, the spiritual realms, according to one interpretation from Mage, you have to take everything in Mage with a grain of salt because it's somebody's perspective, but basically the spiritual realms became the places where the things that humans couldn't believe got shunted off to, basically reality's failures. And that's the way certain mages look at it. And the model kind of works with what they've created, because supernaturals in the World of Darkness are described as surviving on kind of the periphery of human belief. There's what they admit they believe in the middle of, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They're in class, they're studying, and they talk about their beliefs about how the world works. And great, I believe X, Y, Z. Maybe they're religious, but even that is very structured and specific and not particularly horrifying in most cases. But in the darkness, when they're in bed at night, there are the things they're afraid exist. And even if they'd never say they believe it in the middle of the day because they don't want to give it power, some part of them won't let go of it. And that's where vampires and werewolves and mummies can continue to exist without being shunted out as reality's failures. But the Fae are even different. The Fae curl up inside of humans, and the stuff that they feed on, the stuff that keeps them going, the dreaming, glamour, chimerical reality, are what humans dream. Humans don't even have to believe it. And no matter how hard the Order of Reason, which doesn't get talked about a lot in relation to Changeling, but really they're the ones that pushed the Shattering, and arguably their predecessors pushed the Sundering as well. They pushed humans away from belief. No matter how hard they tried to move reality in that direction and shift what humans believe, you can't turn off dreams. That's just not something that can be done. And so, if you're the kind of player that likes to get into the whys and the hows of that and explore that, which can be a little hard to do, but they can be interesting hooks, it makes a lot of sense that chimerical reality is still protruding out. It's like the last spiritual reality protruding out into physical reality, because humans that define all this stuff haven't stopped dreaming.
Yes, and if you go far enough back in Changeling's potential history into Dark Ages and Exalted, it's never quite stated that I remember, but one of the things that drew the Fae, or rather what became the Fae, to reality was human dreaming, because it was this heady mixture of limitless potential and also persistence, and the unshaped and later the shaped and later the Fae were all beings that, according to themselves, imbued themselves with persistence. That's where their weaving powers came from, they tell themselves. And so they, in the earlier part of the World of Darkness history, when there was a lot less persistence and a lot more chaos, they were drawn to the energy that allowed things to continue to exist as they were, rather than the in the modern age, the more rare energy of creating potential and space for other things.
Well, and one thing that I think is really interesting, and this goes back to Exalted, and it kind of relates to Chimerical Reality and the weird chicken and egg Schrodinger's, were the Fae born of dreams? Did the Fae wrap themselves up in dreams? Which is it? That's kind of interesting is if you go back to Exalted and talk about the first time that the Fae folk came into reality, it's the Balorian Crusade, and they were villains, and that most of the details of the story aren't as important. But the thing that really is important here is that in order to make it into reality, they had to make an oath. They couldn't come in on their own. They didn't give themselves form. They forged form through an oath with humanity, which involved humanity becoming aware of them and perceiving them in some way or form or idea. And it kind of gets to the heart of that chicken or egg, which came first kind of dynamic. They were unshaped. The unshaped are a thing, as much as an unshaped can be a thing, a roiling mass of wild. But ultimately, the shaping aspect involved humans. And it gets to that kind of interesting, unreliable narrator of, oh no, we were the originators of weaving and we taught humans, and the Fae would totally think that. But really, maybe the humans did the shaping in that oath. And the Fae folk, just by virtue of going through that oath, learned it. Because ultimately, who's better at it? Humans. And that all seems kind of abstract, but in relation to Chimerical Reality, it, I think, puts an interesting lens on who's creating all of this. You know, at the end of the day, all of Chimerical Reality still really originates with humans.
And you get into one of the better examples of Chimerical Reality, at least one of the more pressing and real examples of Chimerical Reality, in a changeling's mien, their spiritual appearance, which is apparent to them when they go through their chrysalis, although it's not clear whether they're creating that or whether they're just remembering it, which I always thought was interesting. But if you look at the evolution of the idea, which kind of goes backwards from changeling to Dark Ages Fae, to Wicked Masks. In Wicked Masks, you have to create your entire appearance and personality as game traits. And then in Dark Ages, you have this base human-ish form that you layer on top Mien features, which can be traditional story type qualities of your character that may or may not give them extra powers, like having claws or having snakes for hair or anything really. And then when you come to Changeling the Dreaming, everybody's form is pretty much set based on their kith. Knockers all look kind of alike. She all look kind of alike. You have a little bit more variety in Puka and Slua, I think, but not a ton. You can pretty much guess what they are if you do a good enough kenning roll. So you see through those time periods that the Fae, or what became the Fae, go from a state of being really irregular to becoming distinct, separate, recognizable, catalogable things. And that kind of reflects their increased, sustained weaving, whether it's them doing it, humans doing it, or the force of oaths or broken oaths doing it.
Yeah, and for me, it also pointed to the things they've wrapped themselves up in to survive. And that's a consistent theme going through, you know, all of the history of the Fair Folk, if you use all of the prequel material, even though Exalted is very optional prequel material at this point, pretty clearly intended for it, is they're constantly going from unshaped to shaped to, or unshaped to emanation, to shaped to fae, which still have some pretty concrete identities, to changelings, to inanimate, to kith. And as they go through this, they become more and more dependent on having a place to hide, so reality doesn't entirely see them for what they are. That they can take on a form that reality will accept and not completely reject. It's kind of like hiding from antibodies. And so it makes sense that in the more modern nights, beyond just the sort of abstract weaving concept, which does apply, but also by the time they become changelings, they have to wrap themselves up in stories. You know, when it's that give and take of which came first, did we teach you weaving? Did you weave us first? And there's that ambiguity, you know, there's this, do the stories come from the fae? Do the fae, you know, create the stories? Which is it? But by the time you get to the kith, yeah, they're hiding inside people, but they're also hiding inside being recognizable. And it's weird thinking I need to be recognizable so I can hide. But when what you're hiding from is reality, being recognizable is hiding. Because then reality thinks, oh, you belong here. When really...
Right.
They don't.
Right. It's that sad joke. Physics has discovered how to make things invisible, and the sociologist holds up a sign that says, please help.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's very similar.
If you can catalog something, and you can catalog it into a unnoticeable box, that's where it stays.
And that kind of gets to the other thing about chimerical reality, because we've talked about the cosmology and where it came from, but there's also just the story themes it invokes. The other spiritual realms in the world of darkness invoke a few story themes, but are really just they're physical spaces to tell stories in, whereas chimerical reality is really about a lot of narrative psychological stuff. Like, if you go into the Umbra, there's a little bit of the, well, did I really go there? You know, maybe I didn't remember that, but it's pretty solid. You go into the Umbra, you get to keep your memories. But with chimerical reality, you were just at the mall, and everyone saw you, and there's that moment where they're like, no. No, you were just acting weird, but you were here and there was nothing else there. And suddenly you get into the banality dynamics of that statement. And are you... We've all had that moment where we remember something and someone else looks at us and says, no, you're remembering that wrong. And you have to navigate the, oh God, do I trust my own memories? Oh, wait, why is their memory of it the absolute truth? What if they're remembering it wrong, and the backflips your mind does to defend your own sense of, no, this is real? And I feel like while you can tell those stories with the other spiritual spaces in the world of darkness, chimerical reality was really designed to tell those stories. And that's why it's important that it intersects everyday life.
And there are places in chimerical reality and the real world, where chimerical reality is more real than the real world. Freeholds, glens, and other fairly rare but mythical places where the traditional fairyland dynamic comes into play, where you can walk into the spiritual world accidentally, you run into a place where a changeling's Fae Mien is visible by default to everyone present. And God help you if somebody is an unenchanted mortal in that situation. Or you run into a case where it's actually more beneficial for a changeling to deny their chimerical reality, where in chimerical reality there may be a fence, but they suck at climbing. So they could disbelieve that. You take a point of banality and you just walk right through it, probably destroying the fence on the way through.
The other half of that, and we've talked a little bit in other shows about that, I'm taking banality, you know, to get through this. One of the rules in Changeling 20th, and it's listed as an optional advanced chimerical rule, but it really looks like it's going to be more front and center in C20. And again, by the time this plays, we may know the answer to this, are nightmare dice. And the interesting thing about nightmare dice is they represent this weird toxic relationship with the dreaming, but they're still dreaming. They're still vital. They're nightmare. But you can choose to take a nightmare die instead of a temporary point of banality at any point you would take a temporary point of banality. And so the implication there of, okay, I'm going to take the temporary point of banality to resist this, but no, I'm going to take it as a nightmare die instead, where it becomes, I'm no longer getting around this chimerical thing by disbelieving it. I'm getting around this chimerical thing by becoming my most chaotic, toxic self and disrupting the dream in front of me with brute force. The analog still works, but it's an aspect of engaging that doesn't get dealt with very often because it's this oft-forgotten advanced chimerical reality rule. And I think when you frame what it means to intentionally take in that toxicity to do that kind of thing, it opens up a new interesting set of ways to interact with poisoning yourself to accomplish a task, which changelings do all the time.
The thing about Nightmare that makes it a little interchangeable with banality is if you look at some of the rules for the Autumn People and the things they can do with banality, you can use banality to force someone to disengage from the real world. The easiest example of this is somebody who has an obsessive nervous disorder, who has to go through highly ritualized behaviors in order to make it through the real world that don't actually protect them from anything, but it's a thing they have to do that's a response to a stimulus that maybe makes sense to them, but it's not interacting with reality in the same way as the rest of us. And Nightmare is a lot the same thing, only for chimerical reality. With Nightmare, you end up having a chance for one of your cantrips to go horribly awry, or a chance to make manifest for other people to see one of your greatest fears. And where banality shows this toxic relationship with the human world, Nightmare shows this toxic relationship with the chimerical world.
Yeah, and it's interesting because when you think about the sort of metaphor and what it's saying about human experience, you know, anyone who's ever met someone who just refuses to deal with anything or feel and they just turn everything off, that's very much banality. And it's something that, you know, you can do. It's not easy to do, but it can be done, and it's even harder to come out of. But the flip side of that is, you know, people that can't deal with the unknown, with not knowing if something terrible is going to happen, they will constantly self-sabotage and make the most terrible thing happen. If they suffer from high anxiety, they might go in and say, hey, I'm going to make all the worst things come true because at least I know that's what's going to happen. And for me, that's not as terrifying as I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if it's going to be good or if it's going to be bad, and it's all equally terrifying to me. So at least you have certainty. And for me, banality is the I'm going to play it totally safe and not feel anything and not let anyone in and, you know, wrap myself in this routine. And Nightmare is that I'm always going to make the worst thing happen all the time because at least that's certain, and my life will be a chaotic wreck that will, you know, ravage everyone around me. But at least I know that's what it's going to be. So, okay, we can work with that. Even if you aren't prone to either of those extremes. I don't know anyone that hasn't had a close friend that is prone to one, or friends that are prone to either of those extremes.
Yeah, there's a gal I used to know who was a holy roller who would absolutely never, under any circumstances, do any self-reflection whatsoever for reasons unknown to me, but it was really, really clear from talking to her and interacting with her that as long as she was okay with Jesus, she was a good person. Therefore, no work is needed to be done.
Yes, we've all met that person. And that's always an interesting experience.
Yeah, I never quite knew what to do with her.
I've never entirely understood that particular approach either. To me, it's a very... That falls into the banality end for me. The no, everything's totally fine and nothing can go wrong. But, yeah, again, that can go either way. I've at least heard stories about that dynamic going either direction. And all of that stuff, the other interesting thing about chimerical reality, all of that stuff manifests around people. Chimerical reality is much more a reflection of every little whim of what's going on in an area. Not quite so much as the dreaming, but still, it reflects a lot. You summon up chimera, they get born from a whim or an emotional storm or a tantrum, and you have to deal with them. The fact that the term for a chimera that attacks you, the chimera that you could turn around and slaughter without taking banality on yourself, they're called nervosa. I mean, the connection there to what you're dealing with is pretty explicit. And it's an interesting way of looking at things, and it's much more wild and dynamic than a lot of the other spiritual spaces. Although the Umbra certainly reflects some of this, not to the same level, I feel, that chimerical reality does.
Right. Chimerical reality, the way I've always run chimerical reality is that it reflects reality. You're never going to have somebody having a panic attack cause an earthquake, unless they're using a cantrip, but there are going to be ripples. You know, they're going to give birth to a bunch of incidental chimera that maybe don't live out the scene, but the chimera are going to reflect what's going on internally. And if the it's one of the things that I really wish Changeling the Dreaming had done as well as Changeling the Lost did, because The Hedge deals with this sort of thing better. It's got a system for it. You can have control or not over what's going on around you in an intentional sort of way, where in Changeling the Dreaming, it's all kind of left up to the storyteller and how malicious they want to be.
Yeah, and it's been a long time since I've looked at Changeling the Lost, but I do remember feeling like Lost was a lot better at managing a lot of the messy dynamics. Magic was a little bit more flexible. I feel like the way the Arts in the Realms were originally intended to be, Mien's were a little more customizable. All of this stuff fit together in a much more flexible, sort of cogent mold. The game just dealt in entirely different themes, while still invoking a lot of the same concepts, which was interesting.
Remembering the melancholy of human existence, even ghosts can stray from the right path. And then, moving from the more comprehensible, static interaction with the dreaming that chimerical reality represents, there's the dreaming itself, which kind of mirrors the way the other games deal with the Umbra, where you have a near and a far version of it. And I'm going to let Victor introduce those.
So the dreaming is a really interesting place. It's different from the other spiritual spaces in the world of darkness, but at the same time, it's very similar to the other spiritual spaces in a couple ways. So you start out with the near dreaming. And the near dreaming is kind of like the near umbra or the shadowlands in that the areas of the near dreaming sort of sit on the other side of this reality and they react to whatever's going on in that particular location. So the near dreaming on the other side of a graveyard where there had been graves desecrated, you're probably going to have a lot of really horrible nightmare things going on related to death. If things were bad enough, you might even have some black paths of Balor open up, which are pathways from the dreaming directly into the underworld. On the other hand, if the near dreaming at the site of a major Beltana celebration is going to be bright and vibrant and happy and probably really sexy and maybe a little dangerous, but in an enticing sort of way. At the same time, unlike the Shadowlands or the Near Umbra, it's not a direct corollary. You can't just jump across and be somewhere. You have to find a gateway, and you might be able to find a gateway at those last two places I described. The graveyard, it might be possible to get to the dreaming, especially if Asluah were to, say, use some of her dreams, and there's a Wayfair cantrip where you can jump into the dreaming. It's a little more powerful near a Trod, which are the pathways through the near dreaming, but you can't just jump across. And once you're in the near dreaming, even though in theory everything correlates to a place in the real world, you have no way to navigate aside from these trods that lead around the near dreaming from freehold to freehold or into deeper, more intimidating parts of the dreaming. And so, as with all things wild and dream, it's kind of contorted and it isn't what it appears to be. And it's incredibly difficult to navigate. The other thing about the near dreaming that is really kind of dangerous is when the Kithane go there, they immediately start sucking up glamour. All of their boons and banes go into overdrive. Their stats start increasing. A she, even in the near dreaming, becomes incredibly numb to empathy. They become even more beautiful and they become even more powerful. Trolls become even larger. In the near dreaming, they go from being 6, 6.5, 7 feet tall and start inching up above 7 feet, getting on towards 8. The same with Slua. They get quieter, they get weirder, and knockers get very strange. And so the dreaming just gets bizarre, and it doesn't just change the setting, it changes you. And that's just the first level of it. And then once you get past there, it gets even weirder because then you get into the far dreaming. And the far dreaming is a lot like the near dreaming, except it's not connected to any particular place. And all of these stages are kind of connected to human psychology. You have the sort of dreams that you remember, your fantasies, the things you hope for, and that's sort of the near dreaming. The far dreaming are those dreams you can only barely kind of work at remembering, and you only get the edges of them, and so everything gets stranger there, and all of the progression of the Kithane goes even farther. The she in the far dreaming are really terrifyingly powerful. I think you go from getting +2 appearance into, it's something like +5 appearance in the near dreaming. And I think if you get all the way to the deep dreaming, which is the third level, it's like +8. Everyone's sort of personality quirks as defined by their kith becomes more and more and more I want to say, necrotic almost. Like, they become dysfunctional in really deep, sort of frightening ways. The satyrs are rape machines. The trolls will fight to get you to let them protect you and then lock you up in a tiny little room so that no one can ever get to you and no harm can ever come to you. And the landscape itself just gets more and more abstract and weird. The dreaming, honestly, can be very difficult to tell stories in. As much as Changeling is all about stories, aside from the occasional brief excursion into the near dreaming, usually anchored by a particular person's dreams that you're interacting with, that really helps with engaging with the near dreaming if that's your context. The far and deep dreaming are just chaotic, dark, twisted places. They've done write-ups on them, but I feel like they're mostly there as an extreme boogeyman storyteller hook kind of thing, as opposed to a setting you could put in Advanced Chronicle.
Right. So you get into the politics of Changeling a little bit, too, because the places that Changelings are most likely to be entering, interacting with, and leaving the dreaming from are the Silver Paths and the Paths of Baelor, which isn't a great idea, but it's an idea. And in the descriptions of how the dreaming reacts to these things, they're much more ordered and much more like the real world than the rest of the dreaming. And it's invoking the stories about people walking through fairyland and being lured off of the safe path by pile of gold, a beautiful woman bathing, that sort of a thing, and then becoming hopelessly lost when they find out it was just a log floating in the river or it was a pile of leaves, and they become prey for the things that aren't on the safe path.
Which, the things that aren't on the safe path bring up kind of another very interesting dynamic of the dreaming. You know, we've talked about the mists before, and the mists are this thing that protects you as a fae and keeps humans from remembering or understanding you, but they're also a thing that exists in a place. They are a membrane of the dreaming, and if I remember correctly, I think they're between the near dreaming and the far dreaming, I believe. I'd have to sort of go back and look at that again. This isn't an aspect of Changeling I've ever really contemplated using, but technically, you can go back through the other side of the mists and get all of your memories back. You can't then return to Earth with them, because you have to go back through the mists and you will lose them again. But the interesting thing is part of the paths, and especially the silver paths, is the reason those paths are silver is because there was an ancient war between the Tuatha and the Fomorians and the various fae that sided with one group or the other, or played a neutral game to poor effect. And at the end of it, the Tuatha created the silver paths to protect their children and cursed all of the fae that didn't side with them. I don't want to say the fae that sided with the Fomorians. A lot of the fae that they cursed to not be able to go onto the silver paths sided with the Fomorians, but a fair number of them just didn't side with the Tuatha. And they created these silver paths to protect the Cathayn, their children, and so the Cathayn can walk these silver pathways, and they're protected because all of the dark things that never became changelings, they never wanted to push their way into the world because they were, for a variety of reasons, the kiths of these dark kin or the Adheen, stayed in the dreaming. They didn't like the autumn world. They did not have any affiliation with humanity by and large, with a couple exceptions. And so they stayed out in the dreaming. And the silver pathway protects them. Part of the you don't go off the silver path isn't just the getting lost, and you do get lost if you don't have a trod. It's also you go off the path and the dark kin can get to you.
And there's a whole segment in one of the many Xi books talking about how during the second wave of the Xi resurgence in the 80s or 90s, people started coming back with some memories of Arcadia and their experience leaving Arcadia and coming to Earth, and a lot of them reported being harried by fell things even along the Silver Paths.
Yeah, which is interesting. When the Xi came back in the 60s, there's a story in the Denizens of the Dreaming book about how basically they had to have a great war with the Dark Kin because the Dark Kin saw them coming and went, nope, nope, there is no way. We are getting our vengeance now. And they, you know, gathered and the Xi had to fight their way through them. And the Xi, of course, you know, coming out of Arcadia were incredibly powerful, but these weren't changelings they were fighting. These were true Fae in the deep and far dreaming as well. So it was a pretty substantial battle, and a lot of the Xi fell, and the ones that actually made it back to Earth were not the entire group. The thing that's weird and interesting about this, all of this story, is when you go and you look at the prequel text, Dark Ages Fae, the thing, for a long time, I didn't think it was a real prequel. I thought, oh, somebody who didn't like Changeling wrote this thing, because there's no sign of the Tuatha, there's no sign of the Fomorians. They're like there's the seasonal thing, which goes back to when the Seelie and Unseelie were in control, but this is totally different. Took a long time for me to see the connections, and actually having a couple exchanges online with the guy who did it, he is an old Changeling fan, he is now developing C20, but when you go back to Dark Ages Fae, what Tuatha? There are no Tuatha. There are no Fomorians. None of that's there. And I think, I haven't actually talked with the developer about this or had any exchanges with him, but I think it's because they wanted to do the whole remembrance through a mirror, you know, warped, foggy visions. There are these vague connections, but none of the changelings remember it correctly. Then you have these stories in the dreaming, and you have this, well, if you go on the other side of the mists, you have all your memories. And it's like, how do these things connect? Like, how does Dark Ages Fae interact with that? That's a piece I've never been able to reconcile.
Yeah, and I've never used the, if you go deep enough into the dreaming, you start getting your memories back thing, except in the case where somebody dies in the dreaming, because there's a really good hook there describing the death of one of the changelings in the dreaming, because depending on where you're at, you might actually be closer to Arcadia than you are to Earth. And what happens when you're no longer moored to a human body, if you're a Xi, or a human soul, if you're anybody else, and you start to recover your true nature, what happens there? And in at least in some of the material I read for Changeling, what happens there is you start getting all of your memories back. And the closer you get to remembering Arcadia, the closer you are to being reincarnated on Earth, ha ha ha. Which I enjoyed.
That's interesting. That is very interesting. Yeah, I like that. I don't like the idea of you getting your memories back, especially because, in a broader sense, because by the time you're far enough into the dreaming that you've passed the barrier of mists, you're in this situation where you're so deep in Bedlam, because at that point there's no way to avoid Bedlam. You have taken the human part of you, the body that is human, into the dreaming, and you have become something, at least temporarily, that is much more like your true Fae self, especially if you're all the way past the mists and into, like, the far dreaming. And who cares if you get your memories back? Like, you've become that archetypical insanity again. And especially when I was reading the description of satyrs in The Dreaming recently, and they give off this musk that basically makes everyone want them. And even if you would totally, completely loathe them, you want to have sex with them anyway, and they will have sex with you. And they really become all of those things that make the satyrs not a good example of Greek ideals, because the Greeks thought unrestrained sexuality was uncouth and not ideal and beneath them. And the satyrs absolutely become like 110% that. And it's like, how would you even play that? How would you play a perfect paragon of beauty and sociopathy?
Right. I think it's one of the few ways that Wicked Masks did a better job with changeling themes than Changeling did. Because in Wicked Masks, they talk about, they don't call them fae, but fair folk who take on shape, regretting that and destroying their anchors in the real world and passing back into the wild and becoming unshaped again. And the way it's described in that is a little bit more compelling, if not playable, because an unshaped should never be playable.
No, they should not. They're a fantastic story hook, but playable they are not.
Right, and passing like all the way out into the dreaming where you've completely overpowered the part of your identity that's human and supplanted it with the part of your identity that is abso-fucking-lutely insane, you really aren't too far from completely unmaking yourself, especially if a huge part of where your weaving power comes from is your humanity.
Yeah, which makes a lot of sense. So the other thing, talking about these dynamics and humanity and weaving power, is the last sort of little piece of the dreaming, past the weird dark burrows that the Ad-Hein hide in, and the far dreaming and the deep dreaming, and they really become less stable and more a representation of the deepest, most chaotic aspects of the human psyche and dreams, the farther in you get, is Arcadia itself, which is, in theory, if you buy the propaganda, in kind of the deepest little hidden unfindable kernel of the deep dreaming. And yeah, Arcadia.
You can access Arcadia if you're a werewolf.
No, the Arcadian Gate is something else entirely. I have seen conversations about the Arcadian Gate, and I have heard other Changeling players' opinions on it and heard it described, and I'm sticking with that is just a similar name because reasons. The same way I will never view the Fomorians and the Fomori as being related. There's a story there if you want to relate them, but in my headcanon, they are not the same thing. That's just some unfortunate name synergy. Because the Fomorians are sad, pathetic little creatures in a way the Cathayn could never pray to be, and to imagine them as in any way related to the great rising paragons of horror of the dreaming that fought the Tuatha is just not something that I want to wrap my mind around. And I feel similarly about the Arcadian Gate. Yeah, I don't know, Simon, what are your thoughts on Arcadia as it stands in the canon? I know we've certainly talked about alternative ways to look at it for our own games, but
I really just don't have a lot of use for Arcadia. Some of the she splats for the different houses talk about what Arcadia might be like. I've read them and basically immediately thrown them out of my brain and forgotten them. It's just the moon, man. Like, if we're gonna go with the 1960s and the moon landing and making a great lightning strike trod from Arcadia to the Earth, like, I can't get away from it being the moon, and it
Oh,
doesn't work.
it's not the moon though. Like, there are too many other things going on with the moon
But I
that
mean,
are
like,
just not
the moon is
fae-like at all.
madness, the moon is what's in the sky when you're dreaming, like, the resonance is there.
Yeah, the resonance is there, but I don't know. The moon is so substantial to so many cultures, and Arcadia is, just the weird mishmash of cultures that aren't actually related to each other that happen to share Arcadia. But not all cultures, just this mishmash.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
it's just a really poorly thought out plot hook that I don't like very much.
I would love to disagree with you, and I can't. So, now that you have heard our views on Arcadia in the canon, I think it's fair to share some of the ways we've talked about changing Arcadia a little bit. The one thing that I thought would make a lot of sense for Arcadia, if you go back and look at Graceful Wicked Masks, there's this little tidbit about the Unshaped and how the Unshaped tend to actually, when they do manifest, they manifest as places, often non-Euclidean weird places, but they have emanations, which are normal-looking fae. They look like shaped fae. They're not really. And they change and they shift, and they may or may not have normal faces, but you can more or less engage with them. And one of these emanations will be their primary personality, kind of the head. But it talks about how a single unshaped can have emanations that deeply disagree with each other. And you can have a group of emanations that love reality and think reality is just this wonderful, addictive, fantastic thing that they just want to sup on forever. And then a few other emanations over on the other side that are Belorian and think reality is terrible and they want to tear it all down. And those are all aspects of the same unshaped. You know, anyone who's ever been conflicted about something knows what that might be like. So that's in the early, early days of reality. You have a handful of emanations, but there's this hook in there that every unshaped has at least one emanation for every grace, but they can have more. There's not a cap, and they don't describe unshaped with like thousands and thousands of emanations, but there's also no cap. And so I've often thought of Arcadia as an unshaped that the Fomorians were one set of emanations and the Tuatha were another set of emanations, but they were all Arcadian. And they drew a ton of shaped fae from various places, shaped fair folk, into their conflict and, you know, fought with them and maneuvered them. And I think there's a really interesting political story to be told there. But really, it's not some beautiful homeworld to go back to. It's just where the fae lords that dragged you into their political bullshit come from. That's kind of as close to the canon as I've gotten with Arcadia, and still felt like I could tell a story with that.
Yeah, the closer to the canon version of how I handle Arcadia most of the time is that it's almost entirely a delusion that the Fae, in their shaped state, don't have the capacity to understand quite what they used to be. And then, as changelings with human minds, trying to understand that takes them a step even farther away from what they were in the before. And they impose order on it in the way our minds do when we see faces that aren't there and patterns that aren't there. And the whole thing is this story, because the Fae are made of stories, that they're telling themselves that they might be weaving into existence, but they're probably not.
Yeah, I like that too.
It doesn't mesh well with the various steps of the resurgence, and I have to admit that. It's the version of the Arcadia story that I use when I don't have something else in mind.
The other thing, and I think it's worth touching on this, is part of the dynamic with Arcadia and the deep dreaming is, and the far dreaming, the dreaming in general, is it's all kind of European, kind of, sorta. Arcadian Fae more or less encompass the Shi, and I guess the commoners were there, I guess. Maybe not. But when you get into the Darkkin, and this is something that drives me completely nuts about the Darkkin, you end up randomly invoking a couple other cultures. There's one Darkkin, I gotta be honest, I read them and I just put the book down because it was so frustrating. There's a dark kin that is basically a manifestation of Kali. Random Indian, sided with the Fomorians, vaguely villainous dark kin. And that's what we get for India. And I got to that write-up and I'm like, we don't even have a Kith. We have no idea about the Fae that live on this side of reality for India, but we're going to get an Adheen for them, even though the Adheen story is wrapped up in Arcadia. And I walked away from the book. And so there's this weird dreaming, is it European, is it not? But then when you get farther afield, you get other groups of Fae, the Nunahi, for example, where it's very much said they had something like Arcadia, called the Higher Hunting Grounds. Again, you get into they're born of multiple cultures, and they actually deal with the multiple culture a little more explicitly with the Nunahi sometimes than they do with the European Fae, which is interesting. But they had something like Arcadia in the dreaming, but they can't access their dreaming. And what's interesting is the question of, wait, their dreaming, was it a separate place? Was it, is the Higher Hunting Grounds connect, like, what's the cosmology of that? And it's never really been explained, and especially because the European dreaming that they do describe crosses cultures, sometimes randomly much farther afield than the majority of the dreaming seems to be intended to cross. I'm not quite sure what they were attempting with that.
Kind of hand-wave the whole thing in most, if not all, of my games into the dreaming. It's a big place. They didn't talk about a lot of it, and kind of folded the Nunahi, especially, back into the dreaming, because giving them the Umbra instead of the dreaming was a really weird choice that I don't like. And the dreaming gets into weird territory, too, where it cosmologically has resonances with other parts of the stuff World of Darkness did. There should totally be parts of the dreaming that overlap, border, overlay on parts of the Shadowlands, and there should be parts of the dreaming that get out into the places that mages take their inspiration from, because it's inspiration.
Now, to be fair, they did create the Black Paths of Balor, which are very briefly touched on in Dreams and Nightmares and fleshed out a fair bit more in Denizens of the Dreaming. And so there is that intersection with the Shadowlands in the Dreaming texts. There isn't a lot that's done with it. I would really love for the Slua to have access to the Black Paths of Balor, and maybe even to the point where, while the Adheen will attack a Slua off the path for whatever reason, no Adheen aside from maybe the ones that are technically only dead people anyway would dare get near them on a Black Path of Balor. I think that would be really interesting, but they never did that.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason they didn't do that was the Paths of Balor end up being a pretty big political thing that were intentionally created. So they'd have to give the Slua their own thing, or just generic, the dead paths away from Balor.
Well, but the weird thing is, in the write-up on the Black Paths of Balor in Dreams and Nightmares, they invoke the Slua. So I don't, like, they don't say any of the plot ideas I just thought of, but they do talk about everyone's terrified of the Black Paths of Balor because the Shadowlands, and woe be to the Fae that follows one to its termination point, but maybe the Slua aren't afraid of them. Speaking to the intersection of the dreaming with some of the other parts of the world, you know, you have the Paths of Balor, which are all kind of designed to do that. The gold paths lead to the high Umbra. I think the green paths lead to the near Umbra. But then they never became anything else. I think they were just put there so that, oh, well, if you want to intersect, here's where it is. The other thing that gets weird about that is, well, what happens if you make it back to the world through one of those paths and you don't go back through the mists? You know, if there are these black paths of Balor, how do wraiths interact with the mists, given they're a race that really love on the Fae, and obviously the Slua really love on the dead? you know, it.
Yeah, and it doesn't really like leave a space for there to be an organic, natural overlap either,
That's true.
because there are places I've been in the real world that have strong death tones to them that are at the same time inspirational.
Yes, so I see what you're saying there, and I do agree with that. You know, this gets into some weird subculture, you know, overtones, but when I was in high school, I think I was 15, I went to New Orleans, and all of New Orleans is kind of one of those spaces. And at that time, there was a fairly large art gallery that was open and devoted to a very particular modern, I'm going to say neo-pagan for lack of a more precise term, but with the proviso that it's not a great term, but neo-pagan necromantic religious expression, and more necromantic in the Greek sense of the, you know, visions and, you know, communion with ancestors and the dead, not necessarily, you know, what modern people tend to think of with necromancy. But it was very much that intersection of death and art, but in a very significant, meaningful way, not just, oh, we're using a dark aesthetic. And so, yeah, there isn't much room for spaces like that.
And I think partly that has to do with Changeling's European focus more than anything else. Because if we got into cultures that tended more towards ancestor worship, there would totally be a space for that. Because there would have to be a space for that. It's part of the expression of that belief.
Yeah, and that, you know, we've talked about the Nunahi a little bit, and they're sort of weird. They have a dreaming, but it's gone. But is it? But that also leaves the other big group of Gelain, the Hisien, who can get to the dreaming, I guess, if they've completed their we get to go into the spirit world again path.
But
But
they
they don't
also
care
don't
about the
really
dreaming.
care. Yeah.
Yeah, they don't care at all. And it's really strange, and it
Yeah, all
doesn't
I.
leave a space for creatures of inspiration and dream to exist in the East, which makes no sense.
Yeah, the undertone of both the Xian and the Nunahi not having a particular place in the dreaming that they're from or that they belong to. Is that neither of their cultures have dreams, which is kind of hand-waved in the Nunahi case because the genocide killed too many Native Americans, which at
Well, but
least we're admitting that it happened.
even that hand waving doesn't work because then they take the Menehune and say, oh, they're totally part of the Nunahi, Hawaii, yay. And we're just going to ignore that white people are the minority in Hawaii.
Yeah,
Like, not that
like.
there isn't a colonial dynamic there, but the we've tipped over into the there are so few of you, the dreaming that you come from isn't dominant anymore. There is just no form of that story that resonates with reality.
Yeah, I
None.
mean, even the cultural tones, like I haven't read the book that the Menehune are from, but having a little bit of Hawaiian history, I think they've got more in common with Polynesia generally than they do with mainland America, which makes
Well,
them
ho
being part of the Nunahi even more inexplicable.
Yeah, the Hawaii is part of the Polynesian islands, I believe. And they use the term Polynesian fae in that book, and it's a very invoking them in the same breath as the Nunahi nations is a strange choice. But specifically as it speaks to the dreaming, that's really a space where when you get into the myths of Polynesian peoples, there should be a very vibrant dreaming there. And
Yeah.
there is, while the adulteration of Hawaiian lands is certainly a major topic, there's still a fair bit of those islands that are pretty untouched, especially when you get away from the islands with actual settlements on them. And it just there should really be content there. There should be dreaming. There should be stories. There should be their own versions of those Fae that are the equivalent of the Adhene, even if they aren't enemies, even if there isn't a Fomorian story, a group of Menehune that chose not to reside in humans and so stay in their dreaming. You know, that's something I'd really like to see developed.
Yeah, and I'm just trying to wrap my head around the Nunahi nations folding in the Menehune. The only part of that would make sense to me would be if it was like a late development political alliance in opposition to colonization, but that requires them to have a manner of cultural contact, and
that also wouldn't explain the whole mechanical, yeah, totems and Umbra, no, really, you're Nunahi.
Yeah, no,
which
you're
is
right.
How they're designed.
Yeah. And just getting back, just drawing into the end of that point I was trying to make, like, with that cultural contact, there's a huge ocean there, and the Polynesians are great at sailing. That's kind of their historical thing. Why would, like, if that political alliance took place, it would make a lot more sense for it to have, like, been mediated by traveling through the dreaming, I think.
That would be an amazing story. And if the Nunahi in the canon, or perhaps in our individual headcanons, still had access to the dreaming, I know they do at your table, then there's a whole wide political, fun, potential dynamic there that I think could be really engaging. And imagining that part of the dreaming, maybe it's not interconnected with the European dreaming at all, which becomes a very, you know, another aspect of the dreaming that is kind of unwritten. It's there, but it isn't explicitly called out, is the colonialist nature of the dreaming. Because in America, if you're in a city, if you're anywhere even vaguely touched by, you know, the common American populace, you are in the European dreaming. You're surrounded by chimera that trace their roots back to Europe. And there's a really strong colonial narrative there. And, you know, in the books that deal with the Fae and the Nunahi just as entities, it is there, but the dreaming specific aspect of it and how native people react to the influence of the European dreaming is never really fleshed out that I've seen. And I think there's a lot of potential there.
The other problem, though, is you're left behind with the Silver Paths being the only safe way through the dreaming, which I can't imagine the Nunahi would have been the children of the Tuatha.
No, the Tuatha probably did not include the Nunahi in their "these are the people we're protecting" oath. But it does open the possibility for interconnected parts of the dreaming that are actually inaccessible depending on what type of Fae you are, and a Ooh. Whole separate set of pathways and that only the Nunahi know about. And I think there's a really interesting story there, especially because it could open up access to hidden wells of glamour in the Americas that the European Fae never even knew to look for or would have understood them had they seen them.
Yeah, and with the ocean there, too, there's a strong tie to the water elemental in anime, who the anime get a little development in what their part of the dreaming looks like. And the deep Pacific sounds about like it.
Yeah. Yeah, it really does. And you also get into the sort of interaction between, in terms of the dreaming and the ocean and the Polynesian Fae and what their dreaming might look like, you also then run smack dab into the Mer and their sort of weird dreaming dynamic and the fact that they're in a sort of constant political alignment with non-Fae, because all creatures of the ocean in the world of darkness are more bound together by their affiliation with the ocean and opposition to all things landbound than they are by the other little divisions. Like, a Mer is actually more likely to sort of get on with a Wereshark than they are to get on with a Kithane. But the Polynesians have an entirely different relationship with the ocean. And so having this intersection between the Dreaming as the Mers engage with it and the Dreaming as the Menehune engage with it makes way more sense to me than having the Menehune be connected to the Nunahi. Which, I mean, we've talked about interesting ways to make that work, but it still feels like, you know, we're having to make that work. Whereas a connection between the Menehune and the Mer, well, of course.
Yeah, and even the Ondines, like, as much as they're river spirits in anime, I mean, the ocean is way more water than the rivers are.
Yes, it really is. I think the only thing about the ocean that would be difficult for an anime would be, what are you really anchored to? It's almost like the ocean is too unshaped for them to really anchor to, as opposed to a river that has an identity that they can wrap themselves up in.
Well, there are underwater currents and things.
That is very true. And so, and oh, the plate, like, what the Pacific current would be like in the Dreaming. Because that would be a trod.
Yeah.
That would be an amazing trod. And there are some really interesting stories to tell there, I think. Yeah, I feel like there are really great stories to tell there.
As long as you have a cantrip for breathing water.
A cantrip for breathing water, or, you know, you're one of the many, many, many water kith. Especially now that Selkies are a main kith, which a lot of people are very excited about.
Well, they are Irish, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the introduction of the Selkies as one of the core sort of Arcadian commoner kith is kind of exciting and changes the landscape a little bit. Especially because it gives the Kithane access to this part of Dreams. It sort of gives a mediating place for the intersection between water babies and Mer and Menehune in the Dreaming, if you choose to open the Menehune up to the Dreaming, which I really think is the better way to go, and share dreams, because they would all share those dreams. And I think trying to imagine what the topography of those parts of the Dreaming would be is interesting. I think there's a space for a whole different type of trod that the Tuatha wouldn't have been a part of, and Balor wouldn't have had anything to do with, but that all of these water kith can safely travel.
Yeah, that'd be really neat.
Yeah.
Alright, we've talked a little bit about chimerical reality and the Dreaming and how all of those things interact with the real world and the world that changelings experience. If it didn't clarify things, we hope that it gave you some ideas you want to use. We'll talk to you again in the next episode.
The readings from this conversation were from The I Love You Song from 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee and an unnamed poem by Saigyo Hoshi. The music from this conversation was LSD by Mon Plaisir. And now for today's poorly explained echo. Of course fairies hold dance parties in toadstool rings. They need something for the go-go dancers to dance on.